Well, gentlemen, ladies. You've all met Mick by now, so he doesn't need much introduction other than to say he's come a long way. So let's wring the most out of him that we can.
He gets the long distance award for sure.
Yeah. Take it away.
Okay. Cool. I noticed that people are avoiding the front seat. I was going to sweat on you with the activity.
Yeah.
We'll make this quite informal. It's a small group, so feel free to interrupt or make any comments. I'm recording as we go too. I'll eventually put it up on the net, and I'm also using that to record sort of little bits of stories, like the sustainable boat organisation that we talked about a moment ago. I'm putting that up on the blog as I go, so people can feel a bit connected with what I'm doing, because it's sort of a dream trip. And it's happened because of a stupid little boat, the Puddle Duck. I was at the Working with Wood show in Adelaide last year, and we had one of the sleek Goat Island skiffs there and a couple of Puddle Ducks, and some guy was really keen on the Goat Island skiff, you know, sort of looking at it from every angle because it's such a cute looking boat. And I'm explaining that it goes properly, and he had a good strong sailing background, so I'm talking the talk, you know, about performance sailing and modern boats and all modern boats, but doesn't look like a modern boat. And as he was looking, he sort of took a couple of paces back and he bumped into one of the Puddle Ducks. And he turned around and said, "Geez, nobody's cut any corners on that thing." And so it's really great that the Puddle Duck has sort of been Puddle Duck. And the other supporting people, such as Duckworks, have helped to get me here, because the Puddle Duck changed quite a lot of my thinking. It was a real experiment to see how you could take something that was so incredibly basic and then try and make it sail well. The thing about sailing well is a really interesting one. Like, one of the really common things you see on the internet forums and so on is someone starts talking about performance, and then someone else will always say, "I'm just a cruising guy, I'm not interested in performance." And I think that's a really interesting thing, because we found with the Puddle Duck that performance doesn't really take much more effort, and performance also doesn't take much more, doesn't add much to the cost of a boat. I just want to read a little bit that I've snaffled, do you use that word here? Stolen. You know, like if you work on a building site and a pile of 4B2s go missing, someone snaffled them. Okay? So I've snaffled a little bit from the Puddle Duck forum, where Rick Landreville from Canada attended the Canadian Championships for the Puddle Duck. He ended up winning the event, and he just made a little note that the event had been, there were 7 boats, he'd finished first, and there wasn't much description at all of what had happened. The members of the forum started pressing him a bit to find out the details. Now, Rick sailed one of my Mark II, Oz Mark II PD races, which have to conform to the same hull shape, but because I come from a racing background, I can't help myself. But I understood enough about puddle ducking and where I am in the boating world that with racing boats, the high tech just got so out of control. Like, a puddle duck might only cost you $200 or $300 to get on the water. Or if you want to do a really flash one and you've got to buy off-the-shelf sails and so on in Australia, it might creep up towards $1,200. But for a little boat for a couple of kids to get on the water, a type I used to sail when I was young, we used to, parents would sometimes build them during the off-season. They're called the Manly Junior, which is just a little pram dinghy with a mainsail and a jib. At the moment, to get one on the water is about $7,500. That's to get two under 15-year-old kids on the water. more interesting comparison, in a way, is the International Optimist, which you probably know more of the story more clearly than I do. It was designed to be almost that someone could hammer together over the weekend and have their kids sailing the next day, you know, or the weekend after they painted it. And that's how the Optimist went for many years. But now in Australia, they cost about $5,000 to get on the water. So they've sort of lost their soul. They've lost their point. Because within racing fleets, there's this arms race where they just up the ante each time. Someone finds a tiny little advantage to tweak. They win the national championships. Next year, everyone has to have that little tweak. So the Optimist has recovered a bit from that too, because they've changed their wood construction method to be competitive with the fiberglass construction method, which was starting to... The fiberglass construction method has been changed over to a foam fiberglass method, which means the hulls can be incredibly stiff and incredibly light. Fiberglass normally... Straight, solid fiberglass can't compete with wood, just straight fiberglass can't compete with wood, but foam fiberglass can, but at some considerable cost of manufacturing. And the Optimist ended up changing the rules so that the timber boat could be competitive again. So they fixed that part, but in Australia the boats cost about $5,000 to be on the top edge of competition. I think in the USA they're somewhat cheaper. I believe people can get them together for about $3,500 here. But doesn't compare to the dear old Puddle Duck, you know. If you want to spend all your dollars, you're around the 1200 mark. And I think most of us here are from the wooden boat background, build a few boats or seen a few people build a boat. And we're all in the same group that we look at modern race boats, you know, where this idea of performance is, and we're all a bit shocked by the amount of money they spend. It just doesn't seem right for something that is just a simple enjoyment. But going back to the idea of talking about performance and wooden boats is that, like I said, when you mention it on a mention performance, someone always butts in and says, "Yeah, I'm not really interested in performance." And particularly when I'm talking, because I'll always mention performance. But to go back to Rick, he didn't give much detail at all about what had happened, apart from the fact that he'd won. His first message here is, "I know my storytelling sucks, but I am too Canadian to toot my own horn, I guess. So I left out the part where I finished the race, walked to my truck and got my camera, found a bystander to take a picture, called my wife on the cell phone, then did the course again and came in fourth, only a minute and a half behind the two boats that finished second and third. I left that out because that would be breaking." Right. So he's sailing my Oz PD racer. Right. But there was a little bit of discussion about that, and then he made a further comment, which is a little bit longer, and and I think it's more to the point. "Having sailed a regular PD racer, a sail with little or no shape, plywood rudder and centreboard with only rounding on the nose and taper on the back, the centre of lateral resistance of the hull and the centre of effort of the sails in dubious locations, and comparing to sailing to my Oz boat, I can say there's no comparison. The Oz boat feels like a Porsche and the other feels like a 74 Pinto with bald bias ply tyres. I'm no sailing expert, but it would not be hyperbole to say my boat was more than twice as fast as the second place boat. It goes where it looks, points better than 45 degrees, accelerates immediately after tacking, and is less stressful to keep under control. That video clip that Mick has, that's me, where he's spinning donuts in a tight circle, I was doing that around one of the buoys. Try making 5 or 6 laps of a 10-foot diameter around a stationary object in a non-Oz boat. I think the $20 plans are the best deal out there." The part of that really grabs me is where he says the boat goes where it looks, points better than 45 degrees, accelerates immediately after tacking, and is less stressful to keep under control. Like, I think that's the crux of it all. You know, if you consider designing boats from a performance point of view, you get all these really wonderful byproducts. Or, in fact, you could almost say they're the main thing, and the speed is the byproduct. The other observation from this too is that the hulls are all pretty well identical. The boats are all pretty well identical. The difference really lies in the wing in the water and the wing in the air. That's where the difference is. So that's what that means is it's applicable to any boat. The amount of work required to make the difference and the amount of cost required to make the difference is not particularly significant. Probably you're talking in terms of a couple of days, 2 or 3 days of building time, and maybe stretching up a little bit more in materials cost up towards, say, another $50 or $100. You know, it's not really that big a deal. And that's my point, that there are so many great boats out there, and to just look at them in this slightly different way and make some small modifications and to know what you're doing in that regard can give you these huge bonuses.
Are you the designer of the PD Racer to begin with?
No, it's actually derived from the Bolger Brick.
Okay.
The class was thought up by Shorty Rouse. Would you say Rouse? Yeah, I've had problems with the local pronunciation. but Shorty took the idea that it would be just such a simple, cheap boat, and basically defined the class by saying the bottom shape had to be a particular curve. I'm a blow-in, you know, someone who comes along later, and all what I did was I basically brought my racing knowledge to the boat, but wanted to produce quite a sophisticated boat, but do it all in wood and string, right? Because it's all those bits that you have to buy from the chandlery that cost the money. But if you can do it in rope and string and by making your own sail in a simple way, then, you know, that's really great. One of the interesting things is since I've done the plan, and because the plan's relatively cheap, a lot of the other paddle duck designers and builders have ended up using little bits and pieces of it. And the result of that is that the class has actually jumped really significantly in the sailing ability of the boats in the past 3 years. Like, when I saw the boats initially, I was quite dismissive. A friend showed them to me. Actually, the guy who launched the first Goat Island skiff in Australia, Peter Hindman, he showed me the puddle ducks, and I was quite dismissive because I saw the sort of somewhat crappy sails, the poor construction methods, and all of this, and it didn't fit my mindset at all. But then he pointed out something that was really important, and that was that the puddle duck is attracting new people to sailing. And that is an incredibly rare thing because all the mainstream boats have priced themselves out of the market. Like, I talked about the little 8-foot boat for a couple of kids being $7,500. The cheapest boat I can race is probably a Laser, which in Australia is up around $10,000. The cheaper 2-person boats are $12,000 to $14,000. You know, I've never owned a car that's worth half of that. You know? So, yeah, feel really free to interject and ask questions and so on, too. So, another example of... I'll get into more of the detail on that side and where specifically that performance comes from. But I'd just like to use an example of the standard rudder type I use. Like, if someone is asking for a rudder in shallow water, they'll always talk about a swing-up rudder. right? Someone asks on the Wooden Boat Forum, there'll be heaps of advice about swing out rudders. The problem about swing out rudders is when they swing, two things happen. You know, the tiller loads up, so you're struggling, and often if the boat heels, the rudder itself starts skipping across the water rather than having any bite at all. However, this is the type of rudder that's used on race boats in Australia. It's completely ubiquitous. There's no other way of doing it. The beauty is that you can just set the rudder blade to whatever height you like, and you can have either full steerage or, you know, shallow water steerage, and it all still works. And it all still has good bite. You know, so you just have to push it down. Thanks for sanding that. That makes it a lot easier. But on the other side, if you hit something, it still knocks, goes back. So it's got the advantage of the swinging rudder, but it hasn't got the drawback. The other thing is it's just so nice and easy to make. Like I've had maybe 20 years of sailing with rudder boxes that have been like this, and I've sort of built quite a few of them and gradually understood them. That bolt there is the most important thing, because the tiller takes the side loads of the rudder. You know, it's the tiller that turns the rudder head around. The rest of the box does very little work at all. So if that bolt's not there, the whole thing just slips through there in about 10 seconds. But if the bolt's there, the box will last for, you know, the life of the boat. It's light, it's simple, it's easy to make. It's got so many advantages. And slowly it will become universal in cruising boats too. I've seen a very similar system on 50-foot offshore racing trimarans too. The shock cord is replaced with Spectra, thank goodness, but it's still the same principle. It's not my idea, it's stolen. And that's the other thing you need to know about my thinking and my design.
Snapple.
Thank you.
You have a new word.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've just continually got my eyes out for details of boats. I look at all boats, you know, whether it's from a puddle duck through to Ian Alston's designs, through to new race boats and so on, through to scientific literature that appears from time to time about boats as well. My only advantage really is that I've got enough of a technical background to differentiate what's good and bad and what will and won't work. And I've got a second advantage now that I've got a really quite a broad reach of people who are prepared to try things. No. And often they work and sometimes they don't. So, on my website I'll put up a whole bunch of links to bits and pieces too, so that if you're interested in following up details just in the general way, I'd be really happy if you wanted to follow them. Like it says on my website, you know, that in the end I don't care whether a particular person buys a plan from me. You know, I'll bend over and backwards to help anyone. The point is that, you know, all the small organisations that work in wooden boats, all the enthusiasts and so on, we all just want more wooden boats around, and we want more people sharing the joy, such as it is, you know, including the cousins.
So this $20 you're talking about, is that for your high-tuned?
Yeah, that's for the high-tuned.
Is this the high-tuned one I have?
No.
That's one of the original designs of Puddle Duck Racer. However, as he said, in the interim, since his stuff came out, and even though that's an original hull, it's got an Oz-style rudder and an Oz-style balanced lug rig. So
what you're telling me is that
his buddy, or this guy he knew that won Canadian things, knows how to sail, and your snapman or whatever it is of his ideas down at Eugene this past summer didn't help you.
Yeah, I don't care what technology you use, you still have to know how to sail.
But I believe you came from behind.
Well, we didn't go anywhere, just sat there and watched the race. What I'm trying to do is to see, I mean, you have a basic one, and yours is finer tuned, is what you're saying, right?
But, yeah.
Last summer, finished fourth in the Nationals because it was tuned up.
Oh, okay.
I raced it all the previous summer, and then just bundled up the sail, stuck it in the corner, and opened it up, stuck it in the, and went racing. All the alcohols had slackened. I had stolen a block off of it that I forgot. You know, it was just, it wasn't ready to boogie. So,
no, I know that.
That performance shouldn't reflect on the boat. It was just me.
No, but my point is that the plan you're talking about it has been tweaked.
Like the specific areas I changed, the specific things I was interested in were the foil shapes for the rudder and centerboard. There's actually a template in there that means that people shape it in quite a precise way. Like from my racing, going back a long time, we used to just get a bit of plywood and give it a bit of shape, and we sort of knew a bit of theory that the maximum thickness had to be 1/3 back, and the trailing edge could either be fine or, 3 or 4 millimeters wide, or 1/8 of an inch wide and square, and probably glass to give it a bit of strength and so on. So we also used to shape by eye. Right? I used to use a disc sander. Shape it, and then a long block to finish it off. There was one crowd of boat manufacturers in Australia that were eventually ended up producing a boat called the Taser, which was marketed by Performance Sailcraft here. And that's similar to a boat I used to race in Australia, which is just a restricted class, so it keeps changing all the time. At that time, that particular company started producing rudders and centerboards to a very high standard. It used templates, had a very high surface finish. They had specific guys with specific skills hired to do different stages in the process. And you'd go there and you pick up this highly polished board, and you could reflect the light off it, and it was just perfect. You could see no lumps or bumps or anything. And when I put that in the boat that I'd had for 2 years, the things that we're talking about here were really immediately apparent. Not only did I improve my place in the fleet, I went from about 10th out of, or probably 8th to 10th out of 20 boats, to first, second immediately. But the thing that it helped with was it stopped my capsizing. Because suddenly the boat had real grip on the water, it would do what I wanted. Rick said, it points in the right direction, it goes to 45 degrees, the control's less of a hassle. And that's something that's really fundamental to boats. And all it really takes is about another day of process in building any boat. To use a template, to get the consistent shape, to finish it reasonably nicely. Most of this process you're going to go through anyhow. You've still got to, however you shape it, you've still got to shape it. However you glass it, you've still got to glass it. However you deal with it after the glassing, you've still got to do it. So why not invest a little bit more and get the benefits? There were measure tests done on those particular boats that I used to race. And the difference that it made on a normal length race was 4 minutes, because there were lots of those foils being produced, and they actually measured the results because we all had a handicap system, and everyone, you could see how everyone was placed during the system, and we all started off different handicaps. As soon as people got those, 4 minutes would come off their time. Now, 4 minutes might not sound like much, but in a race that's an hour and a bit, it starts to look quite a lot. But then, if you remember, you know, so four minutes in 90 minutes, you know, so say it's a 5% difference. But then, in a normal race, a boat will spend about half its time going upwind because it's the slowest point of sail, and that's the only time that improving the foils will make a difference. So you're looking at a 10% improvement in performance. For every 10 feet you sail, your opposition will be going 9 feet. But, just to go back to the basics, that it improves the handling as well. You know, and the boat just becomes so much more short-footed. You can throw it around more. You can get into nasty little positions on the start line or rounding marks, and you just know the boat's going to handle it. Part of the arms race I was talking about is that all boats are the same now. They've all got good foils. All race boats have good foils, so there's no particular advantage in it. But to utilise some of the technology for our more laid-back boats is a really worthwhile thing. The second place where the Oz PDR differs is that it uses the idea of a flexible mast and a sail cut to match the sail. Right? The idea of that is that when you make a sail, I know you guys know a lot, so tell me if it's all old stuff. But if you have a sail, and I've just done that badly, but say this is the mast, going to be the mast side of it, you create steps in the sail by doing a convex curve here. Right? If you put that on the mast, that gets straightened out, and that extra cloth gets forced back into the sail as depth. However, if you're sailing along, and your mast is flexible in the right way, you get a gut. The sail will be full while the mast is straight, but then as soon as you get a strong gust and the mast bends, then it pulls that excess cloth out and the sail flattens out and it reduces power. The second stage of that is that if it starts bending more, the sail will twist at the top. You know, so the boom is there, the top of the sail is at that sort of angle further up. The sail twisting means that it swings out as if it's been eased at the top. This is all regular stuff for racing people. You know, like, the way that we think about it. But the advantage is that instead of a gust coming along and the boat staggering, and, you know, you've got to let out lots of sheet to stop it from staggering around and becoming difficult to steer and so on, it all happens automatically. The boat, the mast bends, the sail flattens, the sail twists, the boat accelerates in the gust. I wish I could show you some of the videos, but I'll put a link up on my website to the videos of the little puddle duck. Like, you can see that after attack or in a gust or whatever, the boat just scoots.
I think I remember you, in a gust past, you could actually feel the power being put back into the boat. Is it stored in the mast?
Not so much stored in the boat, but what happens is the mast straightens up, the sail becomes fuller, and with the lighter wind that's there now, you've got a more powerful sail, so you're getting a greater proportion of the power out of the existing wind. This is a homemade mast. With the Oz PDR, we had the plans themselves are for the Oz Mark II. There's an Oz Mark I as well. And we built two boats straight up. We did two identical masts for them, and we did two slightly different sails. We found that one sail looked better than the other, but the boats were pretty much the same performance, but the masts were too bendy. You know, my estimate and my caps were a little bit off, and the masts were a little bit soft. I wish I could show you the video again, but organise that all on my website so that it follows through the discussion, and you can see what's actually happening. But, you know, when sailing along, the mast is actually, you know, bending quite like that. And there's also a nice little clip where one of the masts finally breaks and that dumps me in the water. You know, the boat just takes off onto a plane, gets going, then there's this crack and it rolls over on top of me. It's okay, I sailed back on the mast that tall. So with the Mark II boats, we increased the diameter a bit. Like, we already had the standard of the Mark I mast. So we went from 55 millimeters, what's that, two and a quarter, thank you, up to 2.5, 62 millimeters. And that meant that the mast was really solid for one person use.
Master hollow.
Sorry?
Solid master hollow.
They're hollow. Yeah, they're made with half inch thick timber.
Hollow square.
Hollow square.
There's one right there you can look at later if you want.
Yeah. Yeah,
is that a sail for?
That's a puddle boat. That's the sail for that puddle boat there. 85 square feet, 87 square feet, something like that.
For an 8 foot boat, yeah.
What adhesive do you use then in a bending mass like that?
I generally use epoxy, right? But the thing, the advantage of epoxy for general boat building is that it's gap filling. And for someone who wants to sell plans, it's a very confirmatory thing to know that if you specify epoxy, if someone's joints aren't so good or their clamping isn't so good, it's still going to work. So I always specify epoxy in my plans, and that's what I feel confident with as well. No, any sort of pine, fur. I'm trying really hard not to call it Oregon, which is what we call it in Australia.
Oregon pine?
Yeah.
Oregon fir, but yeah, Oregon pine.
Oregon pine.
Yeah.
Are the screws
fasteners in that mask? No, no screws are fasteners.
He's
yeah.
Mine.
Glass or no?
They're galvanized brads in mine.
They're a what?
And then is it going to be glassed at all?
Or no.
You're relying on that epoxy.
Yeah, yeah. And what I... It broke because my mate Peter, who was cutting the scarfs, and like we used this knotty old pine salvage stuff, and he cut out all the knots, and we made the mast staves, the four sides, out of pieces that averaged about that long. And this was for, not for the lug rig, this has got a shorter mast. This is for the sprit rig, which is about 3 feet, no, about 2.5 feet taller than that. 13, 14, yeah. Ah, well done. Well done, that man.
But going back to your question, if your woodworking skills are good and your joints are going to end up tight, then you can use resource and all, which is the traditional mask that you see.
Yeah. I was going to add to that, one of the things the puzzle boats have fed back to me in is that a lot of them want to build boats the cheapest possible way. They use a variety of glues like Type Bond 2, Type Bond 3. And what are some of the other names? PL Premium and so on.
5200 people have built. Yeah. Built Spark for 5200.
Yeah.
Carl Champerton used that. Tinkerflex.
Tinkerflex.
Some people use Gorilla Glare glue, but that's not turning out to be such a great idea.
Yeah, 5200 and Sikaflex I probably wouldn't recommend for mast, because you need those joints to be quite sound. For mast, the alternative glues, the PLPs and Type Bonds, work quite well because it's quite easy to get a nice fit, and if you've got enough clamps to get good clamping, then it'll work fine. Where I worry about them is in the rest of the hull. You know, because I've seen I might be a reasonable boat designer, but I'm a god-awful boat builder. I understand the processes really well, and I can optimize the order and all that sort of thing, but as far as fine joints, I'm not your man.
Well, that would make, I don't know if you know, that was my experiment, that the two bowl club heads are put in by wood carving. But everything else is type on here.
Yeah, yeah.
But not quite everything else. I also tape the seams with epoxy glass.
Yeah. Yeah, like if the seams are taped, that transfers the loads between the different parts, and then, you know, there's nothing that can really go wrong.
And it's held up quite well. I've busted a couple of spoils before anything, and they show no signs of the hole.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so my attitude as a designer is that people can try what they want. I'll always try and find the best way they can use the material they're choosing. But if in doubt, I'll just push them gently back, not so gently, back to epoxy. Alright? Because I just feel confident, I know if something goes wrong, I can interpret what's happened. Yeah, so those are the two main differences of the Oz PDR compared to the others. There are a number of hull differences, and that was just to get the hull weight down. Like when we started building the Oz PD races, I said we were going to use 1/4-inch ply. And most of a number in the PDR community went, oh my god, don't use 1/4-inch ply, you know, like you'll, you know, we're building the boats out of 3/8 and 1/2-inch, and we're having problems with the hull twisting and also oil canning. The reason I went for 1/4-inch was because with Australian racing boats, racing sailing teams, the average thickness of ply is probably 5/32 or 1/8. You know, so I knew that we could get the structure to work. The reason the Oz structure works and is torsionally rigid and stiff is that if you have a look at David's boat, there's nothing in the cockpit, right? So the middle of the boat can actually twist in torsion quite easily.
Does, and even though that's a 3-inch bottom, it will.
Yeah, but what I do with my boats is I habitually break up the interior of the boats using structure, and also build in enclosed buoyancy tanks. Enclosed buoyancy tanks are really quite interesting in terms of structures. Like, if you get a cardboard carton, right, and you've opened it to get something out, it becomes quite floppy, you know. Yeah, you know, like you can push it in any direction and go, it'll twist in any direction. But if you shut the top up and tape it up again and tape it around all the seams, it becomes incredibly rigid and immovable. So you can use that same trick with your boat to cut down the weight of the overall all structure by enclosing area. With the Oz PD races, we use the same bow box as on David's boat, but we put two little side buoyancy tanks in the rear back quarters of the boat. The reason we didn't do them full length is because they would have used too much plywood, and I was trying to keep the amount of plywood down to 3 sheets.
Those side tanks on the Oz, are they dead straight and plumb? Are they angled in at the bottom? Are they curved?
They're angled in at the bottom because that allows two things to happen with the plywood quantity. To keep the plywood quantity down, it means the decks can be quite narrow, and also having them raked inboard, you know, like the cross section near the tank, through the tank, if the tanks come in a bit, that's really quite exaggerated. There's more floor area than that. But the beauty about that is it braces the floor over a wider area, so there's no way that's going to oil can at all. The other thing you can see with the Goat Island skiff is something I picked up from an Australian designer called Murray Isles. He started designing a couple of high-speed powerboats, and he used a really nice simplification of the structure. Like, he built the hulls over bulkheads, just normal ply construction, but he didn't use any stringers on the inside. Instead of putting stringers on the inside, he used the brace drakes on the outside of the boat as the stringers. So that means that you don't have to notch all your bulkheads. You know, really cunning sort of stuff. So with my boat, where I can, I try to put longitudinal sifting structure on the outside, which will also take a bashing if the boat comes up on a concrete ramp or whatever. So if you take the Goat Island skiff shape, it's almost pointy enough to be a Goat Island skiff. If we've got one bulkhead there, one bulkhead about there, bulkhead in the middle, and a bulkhead there. That's all enclosed buoyancy tank. That's the front seat with that section enclosed buoyancy. But that means that the bottom is braced 1, 2, 3, 4 places. Normally those sections would bow in quite a lot. So on the outside of the boat, I've got longitudinal skids that run through like that. And that means the unsupported areas are actually really small. So for Lon's livery boats that he's talking about, that's perhaps a useful structural feature. What it means that your livery boats can be hammered around a bit, but at the same time it means that the plywood doesn't need to be as heavy, which reduces your costs, reduces the weight of lugging them around, etc.
Like
we did exactly the same with a Fenwick Williams cat boat that Duck Flat built about 4 years ago now. The hull was 10mm Western Red Cedar, biaxial glass on the outside and inside, and basically we supported it all with the keel, the seat fronts inside and out, you know, in the cockpit and in the cabin. We had some plywood floors running between the seat fronts and the centreboard case. So the seats provided that part of the grid and the compartmentalisation of the seat stead. And on the outside, we just put a big square laminate on the bilges, exactly where the boat's going to lie down if it goes on the hard, right? So often there's a way to weasel that sort of structure into something in a way that looks quite conventional, right? Well, that's an important thing too. You know, like the boats have a history, and I like to grab bits of the history and reinforce them in a modern structure and try to be intelligent. Like the Goat Island skiff, you can choose any sort of shear line you like, but try and pick I tried to pick one that would look very graceful, and happily it's kind of thought.
You're saying you don't do that on the Puddle Duck racer then?
On the Puddle Duck, we did it a slightly different way. But yeah, that's right. That was one of the toss-ups. We actually built with the careful with those beer bottles. Back row. Yeah, like with the Puddle Ducks, the Mark Ones that we built, we found this really cheap hardwood ply, and it was 532. Built the boats out of the 532, and we thought, well, we're going to be chomping around on the inside, and someone's going to stick their foot through it, so we will put a couple of skids on the outside. However, that ply ended up being, because it was a hardwood ply, it was really, really brittle. And Peter, a mate who's 6'4".
Oh, you're blaming it on Peter now.
Yeah, well, he's the one who put his foot through the floor twice. Right.
Yeah. So you can tell the story that way.
Yeah, yeah. And the other place where he doesn't match up is he doesn't have my cat-like agility either.
It only gets deeper.
Okay, so with the Puddle Duck, we've got the front buoyancy tank, we've got the two rear side tanks. The side deck goes like that, and that's part of the torsion-resisting structure too. So that's the top of the side tank, that inside line, or that outside line rather. We've just got two B1s up on their edge. One runs across there, centreboard case is here, and another one runs across the inside. The Mark 1s had the two runners there, but we put our feet to the bottom anyhow, so I used a method that was taught taught me by a guy who's the Sale International Moth that I used to race against and race with, setting a router to the thickness of the plywood, running around all the framing positions. You can pop the bottom off and glue a new bottom on inside 24 hours. He's done it to get his boat, replace the bottom on his boat to get ready for the next race in a major regatta. And that's one of the advantages of not using fastenings on your boat. The glues are really, really, the glues, particularly epoxy, is really, really, are really wonderful now. The thing that the epoxy has, the advantage, its advantage is that it's forgiving as well. So when Peter put his foot to the bottom of the boat, we cut it off and we just used one sheet of 6mm marine ply. For bottoms of boats, I really like to use 5-ply because what happens with is that when you use 3-ply in the normal format, it's actually most bendy along the outside grain, and that means that it's being bent like this, and the only thing that is stopping it from bending, you know, in that plane is the middle layer, the outside layer, because it's running along the axis of the bend, isn't actually contributing much. And that's why when you have something more rigid like the side buoyancy tank there or whatever, you can end up with a crack immediately alongside. You've probably seen that in some older boats, that when the plywood comes up against the internal structure, you can find that first of all a paint crack, and then you realise the veneer's actually cracked through. So 5-ply is quite useful, particularly for things that are going to flex around a bit. Another way to get around it is to use an epoxy fillet, which tends to be a little bit more flexible just at that edge, and that reduces the risk of it happening as well. You know, so 3-ply is, for the puddle ducks themselves, 3-ply is okay, but 5-ply is a little bit preferable for the 6mm quarter inch bottom.